your radio reading service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading another couple of chapters from The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Gardner, and if we have some time, I'll be reading articles and newsletters from the various organizations that support animals who are our companions. I'm going to begin today's readings with The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Gardner. In the past chapters, we learned that Perry was very intrigued by Helen's story, and it definitely interested him, so much so that he wanted to pursue the case. And now we begin Chapter 5. In Mason's car, driving toward the Castle Gate Hotel, Della Street asked, "Did Franklin Shore put all of his property in his wife's name?" "Just about all, as I understand it. There were joint accounts in the bank." "How long before the disappearance?" "It had been going on for 3 or 4 years." "Then if she wants to keep him from coming back, she could..."
"Couldn't keep him from coming back physically," Mason interrupted,
"but she certainly could embarrass his comeback financially. Suppose the moment he showed up, she filed suit for divorce, asked for a property award, and all of that out of what little property remains in his name. Get the sketch? She'd claim the other property was all hers."
"You think that's what she's planning?"
Mason said. "He certainly has some reason for wanting me there at the conference. I don't think he wants me to play tiddlywinks." They were silent for several blocks. Then Della Street asked, "Where do we meet the others?" "A block from the Castle Gate Hotel."
"What kind of a place is it?"
"Second rate, down at the heel hotel, an outward front of respectability, but it's a thin veneer."
"And Henry Leach wanted Helen Kendall and you to come alone?"
"Yes." "Think he'll object to the four of us?"
"I don't know. There are some peculiar angles, and I want notes taken so I'll know what is said and what isn't said."
"Up on the next corner is where we meet the others. Here's a good parking place." Mason eased the car into the curb, switched off the lights and ignition, and he helped Della Street out. Then he locked the door. Two figures detached themselves from the shadows of a doorway. Gerald Shore came forward to shake hands. Introductions were performed in a low voice.
"Coast all clear?" Mason asked.
"I think so, sir."
"Yes."
"You haven't been followed?"
"Not as far as we can tell."
Helen Kendall said, "I'm quite certain no one has followed us."
Mason nodded toward the building in the middle of the next block, where a section of blank wall rising above the top of the nearest house had been lettered, "Castle Gate Hotel, rooms $1 and up, monthly rates, transients, restaurant." The sign had been faded and sooted by grime by the big city. Mason took Helen Kendall's arm.
"You and I will go first," he said.
"Sure. You and Miss Street can follow after an interval of 20 or 30 seconds. Don't appear to be with us until we start up in the elevator."
Gerald Shore hesitated. "After all, the person I want to see is my brother Franklin. I don't care about seeing this man Leach. If my presence may frighten him, I'd prefer to sit and wait in the automobile."
Mason said, "Miss Street is going with me. That'll make three of us. You may as well make four."
Shore reached a sudden decision.
"No, I'll wait here in the automobile, but the minute you meet my brother, I want you to tell him I'm here and that I simply must see him before he talks with anyone. Do you understand? Before he talks with anyone."
Mason regarded the man quizzically. "Before he talks with me, with anyone."
Mason shook his head. "If you want any such message delivered, deliver it yourself. The man has sent for me. He probably wants to consult me professionally."
Shore's bow was courtly.
"My mistake, counselor. I'm sorry, but I'll wait here just the same. I doubt that my brother is in that hotel. When you come out with Leach, I'll join you then." He walked back to a place near the corner where he had parked his automobile, unlocked the door, got in, and sat down. Mason smiled reassuringly at Miss Helen Kendall. We may as well go. They walked along the echoing, all but deserted sidewalk to the drab entrance of the outdated hotel. Mason held the door open for the two young women, then followed them in. The lobby was some 20 feet wide, running back to terminate in a U-shaped desk and counter behind which was a switchboard. A somewhat bored clerk sat, reading one of the more lurid True Detective magazines. Across from the clerk were two automatic elevators. There were some 15 or 20 chairs in the lobby, for the most part arranged in a row along one wall. Half a dozen individuals sprawling dispiritedly in the chairs raised their eyes to look, at first casually, then with sharpened interest, at the two trim, slim, waisted young women, followed by the tall figure of the lawyer. The clerk at the desk glanced up from his magazine and did them the honor of letting his attention remain on them. "You have a Harry Leach registered here?" Mason asked as he reached the desk. "Yes." "Been here long?" Mason asked. "About a year." "Indeed. What's his room?" 318. "Will you ring him, please?" The clerk, who apparently was also the telephone operator, moved over to the switchboard and plugged in a line. He pressed a button several times while holding an earpiece against his left ear. His eyes studied Della Street and Helen Kendall, and they were very interested, but he made no effort to conceal his interest. "I'm sorry, he isn't in." Mason looked at his watch. "He was to meet me here at this time." The clerk said, "I didn't think he was in. A man came to see him 2 or 3 hours ago. He was out. I haven't seen him come back. He broke off as a special delivery messenger came up to the desk. "Got a special delivery for the clerk at the castle gate," the boy said. The clerk signaled for a special delivery, opened the letter and read it, then looked up at Mason. "Are you Mr. Perry Mason?" he asked. "That's right." "Well, I guess Leach was to meet you all right. It's really for you, but he addressed it to me." The clerk handed Mason a sheet of paper on which the message had been neatly typewritten. "To the clerk at the Castle Gate Hotel. A gentleman will call for me tonight. His name is Perry Mason, lawyer. Please tell him I cannot keep the appointment, but he is to come at once to place indicated. Circumstances have necessitated a change in plans. This is unfortunate. Tell him to drive, please, to the reservoir near top of the road back of Hollywood, according to course traced on map enclosed herewith. Once more, excuse, please, change in plans. It is unavoidable." Signed, Henry Leach. The signature as well as the message was typewritten. The map, which was enclosed with the letter, was an auto club map of Hollywood and vicinity. An ink line had been traced along Hollywood Boulevard, turning to the right on Ivar Street, then following the winding course to a spot on the map marked Storage Reservoir. The clerk said, "I thought he went out a couple of hours ago. I haven't seen him return." Mason studied the special delivery letter, abruptly folded both letter and map, and shoved them back into the side pocket of his coat. "Let's go," he said. The headlights of the two automobiles twisted and turned alternately, showing dazzling circles against a cut bank, then swinging out to ascend a parallel cone of light across the dark canyons. The road snaked its way up the mountain, climbing steadily. Mason and Della Street drove the car in the lead, Gerald Shore and his niece following in their car. "Did it strike you there was anything strange about that letter of instruction?" Mason asked. Della Street, her eyes shifting alternately from the map to the road ahead, said, "Yes, it was vaguely familiar in sound, as though I knew the person who had written it. A sort of style of expression, I guess. I guess that's what you might call it." Mason laughed. "If you heard it read aloud in the proper tone of voice, you'd recognize at once what it was." "I don't get you," Mason said. "Try bowing and smiling as you read the lines out loud. Then read them without an expression, in a monotone, and see what you get." Della Street unfolded the letter from the envelope, started reading. At the end of the fourth line, she said, "Good heavens, it's a way a Japanese would write." Mason said, "You couldn't have made a letter sound more Japanese if you deliberately set out to do it. And notice that the signature is typewritten. Also that the letter is addressed simply to the clerk at the Castle Gate Hotel. Leach has been staying there for a year. He'd almost certainly have known the clerk by name and would have addressed the letter accordingly. Then you don't think we'll find Leach up there? You think this is a wild goose chase?" "I don't know, Della. I noticed that peculiar style of expression and wondered if you'd noticed it too." "I hadn't at the time. I suppose I would have if I'd heard it read aloud. Now that you've pointed it out, it's perfectly plain." Mason shifted the car into second, pushed the throttle well down, sent the big machine screaming around the curves. For the space of several minutes, his hands and arms were busy with the steering wheel. Then the road straightened somewhat and leveled off. All around them was a black rim of quiet mountains. Above this rim was the steady stars. Behind and below, a carpet of twinkling lights extended into a huge crescent for a mile upon the road, marking the location of Los Angeles, Hollywood, and the suburban towns, an apparently unbroken cluster of a myriad pinpointed lights interspersed here and there with blobs of color from neon signs. Against this vast sea of illumination, the outlines of the mountains up which they had climbed were dark, patient silhouettes. Mason slipped the car back into high gear, eased the pressure on the throttle, and the powerful silent motor in the big car became a mere whisper of synchronized power. Through the open windows, the silence of the mountains seeped in, a silence that was broken by the sound of tires gliding over the road and the ominous whoo-whoo-whoo of an owl. A moment later, the lights of Gerald Shore's car were reflected back from the windshield and rearview mirror in Mason's car, patiently blinding them by their glare, so that it was not until Mason was almost on top of the parked, unlighted automobile that he saw it and swerved sharply to the right. A few yards ahead, the road curved abruptly, and a circular fringe of eucalypti marked the location of the reservoir. "This is it, Della." Mason pulled his car to the side of the road and parked. Gerald Shore swung in behind the lawyer. Both drivers switched off headlights and their motors. Almost instantly, the silence of the mountain spaces engulfed them. From under the hood of Mason's car, the cooling motor block gave forth little cracks of sound, which were magnified by the surrounding silence until they became a distinct explosion. The sound of Gerald Shore's feet coming up from behind seemed unusually loud. Adjusting his voice to the quiet which surrounded them, Gerald Shore said, "That must be the car back there, but I didn't see anyone in it." There was an uncertain note in Della Street's laugh. "It doesn't look much like a party to me," she announced with a nervous flippancy. "Are you sure they said Tuesday night?" Helen Kendall's voice from behind Gerald Shore was sharp with apprehension. "There's someone in that automobile sitting behind the steering wheel. He hasn't moved, just keeps sitting there, waiting." "Got a flashlight?" Shore asked. "Somehow I feel uneasy about this whole business. There's no reason why my brother should have decoyed us up here simply to meet him." Mason said, "I'll get a flashlight." He opened the glove compartment of the car, pulled out three electric flashlights, and said, "Come on, let's go." They formed a compact little group as they marched back along the road, the flashlight spraying a circular spot of white light on the ground. The parked automobile remained dark, silent and motionless. There was no sign of life from within it. Abruptly, Mason raised the spotlight so that the rays shone through the windshield. Helen Kendall only half checked the exclamation of startled horror which came to her lips. The body was slumped awkwardly against the steering wheel. The right arm was half circled around the wheel. The head was tilted to one side and rested against the shoulder. A sinister red stream had flown down from the left temple, had divided at the line of the cheekbone, contrasting in color with the hue of dead flesh. Mason stood still, holding the spotlight focused on the inert body. He said over his shoulder to Gerald Shore, "I don't suppose you could identify this man, Leech."
"No, I've never met him."
"This isn't your brother?" Mason asked, moving a little to one side so that the spotlight would illuminate the features to better advantage.
"No, you're certain?"
"Yes." Mason deliberated a moment, then said, "Lieutenant Tragg of Homicide is always claiming that I violate the law by moving bodies and destroying clues before the police get on the job. This time I'm going to be above suspicion. If Miss Kendall isn't afraid to stay here, I'm going to leave you two to watch the body while Miss Street and I rush down to the nearest telephone and notify the Homicide Squad." Shore hesitated for a moment, said at length, "It will only take one to do the telephoning. I'd like more than one witness here."
"Willing to stay?" Mason asked Della Street. She met his eyes.
"Of course." "Okay. Miss Kendall, what's your aunt's telephone number?"
"Roxwood 33987.
"Why? Are you going to notify her?"
"No," Mason said, "but I thought I might call the house. I may want to ask the houseboy a question."
Mason jumped in his car, hurriedly slammed the door shut, stepped on the throttle, and went snarling in second gear down the winding grade. He stopped at the first house when he saw a light, ran up the steps, and rang the doorbell. It was a somewhat pretentious mansion, typical of California Sidehill construction, one floor on the street side, then descending in a series of floors and balconies on the downhill side, away from the road. Mason saw the figure of a man moving leisurely across a corridor. A porch light clicked, etching him into sharp brilliance. A small window in the door slid back. A pair of keen gray eyes surveyed the lawyer.
"What is it?" a man's voice asked. Mason said, "My name is Perry Mason. I want to use your telephone to notify the Homicide Squad that a man's body has been found in an automobile up on the reservoir at the top of the hill."
"Perry Mason, the lawyer?" the man asked.
"Yes. I've heard of you. Do come in."
The door opened. The man, wearing a smoking jacket and slippers, peered curiously at Mason and said, "I've read a lot about you in the newspapers. Never thought I'd meet you this way. The phone's there on that little stand over there." Mason thanked him, picked up the phone, dialed Homicide, and asked for Lieutenant Tragg. A few minutes later, he heard Lieutenant Tragg's crisp, incisive voice on the line.
"Perry Mason," the lawyer said, "I have something to report."
Tragg said, "You aren't going to tell me you found another body."
"Certainly not," Mason replied promptly.
"Well, that's better. What's the trouble?"
Mason said, "I've quit discovering bodies, but one of the persons who was with me discovered a body in an automobile up near a reservoir above Hollywood. If you want to start now, I'll meet you at the corner of Hollywood and Ivar and show you the way up."
"Oh," Lieutenant Tragg said with elaborate politeness, "someone who was with you discovered the body?"
"That's right."
"Since you've used up your quota," Tragg said sarcastically, "I presume that you've got your estimable secretary claim the credit for this one."
Mason said, "It's all right with me if you want to sit at the phone making wisecracks instead of investigating a murder, but it'll sound like hell in the newspapers."
Tragg said, "Okay, you win. I'll be right out."
Mason hung up the telephone and dialed Roxwood 33987. After several seconds, during which Mason could hear the sound of the ringing bell at the other end of the line, a woman's voice answered the telephone.
"Yes, what is it?"
she asked in a sharp, high-pitched accent.
"You have a Japanese houseboy," Mason said. "I'd like to talk."
"He isn't Japanese, he's Korean."
"All right, whatever nationality he is, I want to talk with him."
"He isn't here."
"Oh, he isn't?"
"No."
"When did he leave?" Mason asked.
"About an hour or so ago."
"Who are you?"
"I'm the cook and housekeeper. It's supposed to be my night off, but I came in just as they left and told me to stay here and answer the telephone in case anyone called."
"Could you tell me if this Korean servant has been in the house all evening?"
"Well, I couldn't exactly. I think he was out for a while."
"And where is he now?"
"Out?
Can you give me any more information than that?"
"No."
"I'm Mr. Mason. I'm calling on behalf of Gerald Shore, and I want to know where this houseboy is now."
You're calling for Mr. Shore?
That's right.
If I tell you where Como is now, you'll see that there won't be any trouble, will there?
No, I'll take care of that.
He's taken Mrs. Shore to the Exeter Hospital.
To the Exeter Hospital?
Mason repeated in surprise.
Yes, she was taken very sick all of a sudden, like looked at as though she'd been
what?
Mason asked.
Nothing at all.
When did this happen?
About 9:15, I think.
Looked as though she'd been what?
Mason insisted.
The woman on the other end of the line hesitated a moment, then said sharply,
poisoned,
but don't tell anyone I said so,
and hung up the telephone.
So now we have a cat that's been poisoned, and we have Mrs. Shore who's been poisoned. What is going to happen next in the case of the careless kitten, written by Earl Stanley Gardner? Our next reading comes from the Seeing Eye Guide, a magazine for friends of the seeing eye, Winter 2026, Volume 91, Number 3. The article, Accountant Turned Attorney After Employment Discrimination. In 2010, an accountant named Heather Davis was driving when her vision went blurry and she felt a sharp pain in her eyes. Her eye doctor diagnosed her with diabetic retinopathy. I had developed gestational diabetes while pregnant with my last child, but then they did not require eye exams, so I had no knowledge whatsoever that it was affecting my eyesight, Heather said. 6 eye surgeries over the next year failed to save her vision. So what did I do? I laid down on the couch and cried and had a temper tantrum, went through every stage of grief you can imagine, and then, after 3 weeks of that, I said, you know what? I'm not going to live this way. Heather got off the couch and went to work with an orientation and mobility instructor who taught her how to use a white cane, how to cook as a blind person, and other life skills. He also recommended that she consider working with a guide dog. Heather came to see our dogs at the Seeing Eye in 2012 to be matched with her first Seeing Eye dog, a golden retriever named Fern. I can only begin to tell you what it was like when I walked through those front doors. It literally changed my life. Heather said at first she felt like she didn't hit it off with Fern. Everybody's dog is laying at their feet, hugging them, leaning on them. My Fern is sitting at attention right next to me, making it quite clear that she will work for me, but she doesn't have to love me. I called my husband and said, the dog doesn't like me. That changed quickly, Heather said. By the time we left the Seeing Eye, Fern relaxed by putting her head in my lap or her head on my feet. I knew then that I had gained her trust. While still at the Seeing Eye, Heather spoke with her employer, a large energy firm in Texas, about returning to work. To her surprise, her employer said she wouldn't be permitted to bring a Seeing Eye dog into the office with the help of the Seeing Eye. Heather fought against this policy. The Americans with Disability Act specifically allows Seeing Eye dogs in the workplace. Even after acknowledging that Fern was allowed in the building, the company tried to enforce other restrictions, such as requiring Heather and Fern to use a service elevator. They kept saying they weren't restricting my access, only Fern's, and I kept saying that Fern is my eyes and I can't go anywhere without her. They just didn't get it. Heather was undaunted. Obviously, they didn't know who they were messing with, she said. When efforts to work with the company's human resource department proved unsuccessful, Heather went to the United States Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and eventually won a settlement against the company for discriminating against her. The battle convinced Heather that she should keep fighting on behalf of others. She enrolled at the University of Houston Law Center to get a law degree. Fern went to law school with me. She was known as the law dog. One, we went into the county courthouse, and we were welcomed by every judge, Heather said. While still a law student, Heather said Fern began to develop arthritis and started slowing down. In 2019, Fern retired, and Heather returned to the Seeing Eye for her second Seeing Eye dog, a golden retriever named Brianna, or as she's known around the courthouse, Law Dog 2. With Brianna at her side, Heather graduated cum laude from the University of Houston Law Center, getting not only a Juris Doctorate but a Master's of Law degree. She now has her own practice in Houston, specializing in elder law, family law, and finance law. Heather was the graduate speaker at the Seeing Eye Donor Reception, held on October 23rd. She also spoke to donors at an event in Houston in April. "The reality is, I couldn't have what I have today if it wasn't for the independence and the confidence that I have gained from being a Seeing Eye dog handler. I would not be where I am today without Fern and Brianna," Heather told the donors at the event on October 23rd. This article, Heather Davis, accountant turned attorney after employment discrimination, is in the Seeing Eye Guide, a magazine for friends of the Seeing Eye, Winter 2026, Volume 91, Number 3. Well, that brings us to the conclusion of Animal Companions for today. I do hope you've enjoyed the readings, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.